Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Today, in advance of the third annual New Mexico Women Authors Book Festival, which is happening this coming weekend, Friday, October 1st through Sunday, October 3rd, from 11 to 5 at the New Mexico History Museum, we are talking to 10 different women authors. I'm happy now to welcome Leslie Poling Kempis. She is the author of many books, including The Harvey Girls, Women Who Opened the West. Welcome.
Thank you.
So this is a book about the famous Harvey Girls, and there was a new book recently about Fred Harvey. What was your interest in writing about these young women? Who were they?
Well, in the early 1980s, I was working on the documentary film Fred Harvey and the American West here that was made here in Santa Fe, and we had so many responses from across the country from former Harvey employees. I didn't know who the Harvey Girls were. I was raised in New York, although I've lived in New Mexico since the 70s. But it became evident that there was a lot of history that was just sitting out there. And this was sort of the beginning of women's history. You know, it was something new in universities, and people were suddenly interested in what women had to say about history. And so I began to go out and interview women and men who had worked for the Harvey Company. I traveled 11,000 miles. I drove to tiny towns from Chicago to Southern California to find these people and talk with them about their lives. And there are about 80 people that I depended on, you know, for this book. And they had extraordinary stories. And I learned the Harvey Girls were 100,000 women who came into the Southwest from the 1880s until World War II. And they worked as waitresses in the Fred Harvey system along the Santa Fe Railway. They had to be 18 years of age. They witnessed extraordinary times. They were often the first Anglo-American women into many of these communities. And they were interesting. They had a lot to say about their life and times.
And when you were writing about this, the book, you first published this book in 1989, there were probably more Harvey Girls then than there are now, because the company went out of business in the, when was it? Sometime in the first half of the 20th century.
Well, in the 1960s, it finally sold out to AmFac. But, yeah, it was good that I interviewed when I did. Many of the women that I interviewed were gone by the time the book came out in 89. I purposely chose the oldest and went to find them first. Yeah, it was really sort of providential that I stumbled into this story and did it. I didn't know what I had when I was writing it, and it took a while to get it published, and then it was picked up by a New York publisher, and it has been in continuous print for 20 years. It's really been amazing, and I wouldn't have known it at the time when I was writing it, that it would have this long life. And whenever I speak about the Harvey Girls, I get a lot of people come out. There's a lot of nostalgia around the trains. And that whole era.
Now, when the very first Harvey Girls came out to places like here, like New Mexico,
Raton was the very first place.
Yeah, they worked as waitresses at restaurants. They were the way in my mind. Tell me if this is historically correct. They were young, like late teenage, corn-fed, single Kansas girls.
They, a lot of them were from the Midwest, and what I learned was that they weren't so much adventurers as they were. Their families needed them to work, and this was at a time when women didn't go to work, and waitressing was at the bottom of the, you know, a women's job scale. It was pretty bad, and so Fred Harvey had to institute this whole system in which women were protected, taken care of, paid well, and that their families felt all right about them leaving home, and then. You know, and then they worked for this amazing company. But yes, they were waitresses, but there are a lot of rules that they had to live under.
They couldn't get married for the first 6 months.
That's right. They could see there was going to be a problem if they didn't sign contracts. And I interviewed people, women who had been fired for dating without permission. You know, there were dating rules. The rules changed over the years according to the time, you know, the era. By World War II, the rules had relaxed quite a lot because... they needed a lot of women to serve the troop trains during the war. So there are all kinds of changes. And the old Harvey Girls, the ones that predate World War II, will say, after the war, they weren't the same. You know, Harvey girls didn't have the same standards, so I guess it changed quite a lot.
What do you mean they weren't the same?
Well, they didn't have to go through such rigorous training after the war. And also after World War II, the railroads were losing ground to airplanes and automobile travel, so it just wasn't the same as it was before the war.
So when you think about the Harvey girls' effect on American society and the place of women in the workforce, what would you say in closing was their effect?
Well, I think, you know, I don't know if I'm answering this exactly, but I found that a lot of women who will talk to me about reading this book or hearing me talk about them say they would have loved to have been Harvey girls. And I think it's because it's sort of this example of women leaving home, doing something adventurous far away from home, being on their own in a beautiful place. And there's a certain romance around that.
Leslie Poling Kempis is the author of The Harvey Girls, Women Who Opened the West, and we will see you at the New Mexico Women Authors Book Festival.
Thank you. I'll be there on Saturday afternoon.
Excellent.
Thanks.
I'd like now to welcome Barb Awalt. She is the author of Faces of Market, Traditional Spanish and Contemporary Hispanic Market. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
I'm pleased to be here.
Very much a Santa Fe book.
Yes, it is. This book was the result of having 20 years of pictures all over my house and office, and I put it together. It's really a scrapbook, a glorified scrapbook, when you think about it.
Now, you've been going to Spanish Market or contemporary, well, there wasn't contemporary Hispanic Market when you started going.
Mm-hmm.
There was just Spanish Market.
Right.
And what drew you about it?
Well, one of our very good friends is Charlie Carrillo. And we went to our first traditional market because he was in it. We wanted to look up what he was doing, and we got to know him. And from there, we have a lot of relationships with other artists in traditional market. And then we got hooked on contemporary market, and this book kind of grew out of that experience.
And it's as much about the people as it is about the art.
Exactly. Because without the people, you can't have market. And that's one thing we wanted to stress. Some of these, and unfortunately most of them are Anglos, say, well, you know, we can have the art, we can have the traditions. You can't have it without the people that make the art. And that's important. And through our 20 years at Market, some people have been treated very badly. So,
what do you mean?
Well, artists have been thrown out of traditional market for really stupid reasons, and all but one have come to me, non-lawyer that I am, and say, hey, you know, I was thrown out. What can you do for me? And I got them all back in except for the one that didn't come to me. But I said, in one artist's case, his artwork was in the collection of the Spanish Colonial Design organization, their museum. And I said, you know, you better put him in because we're going to take this to court. And it went in very quickly. And because of Stuart Ashman, who is now the Director of Cultural Affairs, well, he was Director of SCAS at that time.
Of what?
Of SCAS, the Spanish Colonial Arts Society. And he went up to Grants, New Mexico, and met with the artists and put him back in. And, you know, he did a good job. Another artist was thrown out because he made muertes, those Day of the Dead type figures in carts. Well, they said that was Mexican. Well, I hate to tell them, but New Mexico was part of Mexico for a long time before it was a state. And they had other artists in with muertes, so that wasn't a good reason he got back in.
It's very tricky, this thing of what is traditional, because what is traditional changes if you let culture develop naturally, as it always does, and you run the risk of freezing it in time.
Well, unfortunately, tradition is not changeable because they don't let it be
changing.
That's what
I mean, yeah.
They don't let it grow. So it's very documented what art forms were allowed and what were kosher art forms, and they don't seem to want to, you know, find out what was real, what wasn't. The Best of Show winner 2 years ago was a beautiful piece of furniture with Russian iconic all over it. It had Russian symbols. Well, to my knowledge, we weren't part of Russia, but I could be wrong. you know, in the last traditional Spanish market, it wasn't Best of Show, but a piece won major awards because it was mariachis holding a microphone. Well, again, I don't think microphones were a traditional art form, but I could be wrong on that, too.
Barb Ewald's book is called Faces of Market, Traditional Spanish and Contemporary Hispanic Market, and we will see you at the New Mexico Women Authors Book Festival this weekend.
And it's a great place to go, and people should come and enjoy themselves.
Excellent. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'd like now to introduce Mary Naber. She's the author of the novel Speak Right On, Dred Scott. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you for having me here.
Now, the Dred Scott decision is, what would you call it, a dark spot in American history?
A blot, for sure. Yeah. In fact, a lot of people are hearing his name today because of debates over the 14th Amendment being repealed, and everyone's talking about the Dred Scott decision, which is that blot. The Supreme Court ruled that Dred Scott and his family could not be freed under laws that had freed already 200 more and more slaves in St. Louis at that time.
Now, what time, when was this?
Well, the Supreme Court decided in 1857, but Dred Scott brought his case in St. Louis in 1846. So it was a 10, 11-year haul in the legal battle for this freedom that he then lost.
Now, you have written somewhere that people write about what they want to know about it. You know, there's this sort of cliche, people write what they know. You write about what you want to know. What was it about this case and this character that fascinated you?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because I just think that as an icon of American history, Dred Scott has been overshadowed by the case that bears his name. And so I wanted to know about the man, and not so much about the case. And there are libraries dedicated to the case. But the man himself, no one bothered, probably because it was ruled that he was a slave, no one bothered to keep biographical information.
So how did you do the research?
I did it with great love and great discipline. I was living in St. Louis at the time, so I was able to do a lot of research. What it wound up being was about the culture in the mid-19th century of slavery, about the legal landscape during that period, and the ancestry of some slaves going back to Africa. So I actually was able, in my character of Dred Scott, to bring all of that together.
What, from what you could piece together, was he like?
Well, you know, it was so important to me to hear him. We know that historically he was a very small man, probably under 4 feet.
Under 4 feet?
Oh, I'm sorry. under 5 feet.
Oh, okay.
He was 4 foot something. I'm sorry. So he was very slight. And so that suggests in the culture he wasn't a field hand. He was probably a house servant. And we also know that he was illiterate, because he signed all of his court papers with an X. So this got really fascinating to me. How did an illiterate, enslaved man, how did his voice get to the Supreme Court?
And is more famous than so many other people in American history. Everybody's heard of him, whether they know exactly what happened in that case or not.
Well, it was a little bit sad when the book came out, because I found out that people confused him with Nat Turner, who led a slavery revolt in the same period.
Yeah.
And Dred Scott is so different. Nat Turner led an insurrection that was bloody. Dred Scott tried to use the laws that were on the books to gain his freedom. And it's such a different way of going about trying to reach the same thing and protest the same thing.
And one imagines that a character like Dred Scott, if he were alive today, he probably would have ended up a lawyer.
You know, he certainly wouldn't have been illiterate. And he may have gone into the law, but I envisioned him, I mean, if you've been through a court case, you know you learn a lot once you go through it. But I envisioned him as a storyteller. And that is one of the major components of this character in the book, that almost in compensation for the denial of being educated, he drew upon the rich traditions in African folklore and storytelling, so that is how his voice grew and developed.
Mary Naber is the author of the novel Speak Right On, which is about Dred Scott, and we will see you at the 3rd Annual New Mexico Women Authors Book Festival.
I'm looking forward to meeting people there. It's just a great opportunity. Thank you so much.
Great to have you. I'm very happy now to welcome Carla Aragon. She is the author of the children's book Dance of the Eggshells, Baile de los Cascarones. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much, Mary Charlotte. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, this is also very much of a Santa Fe or northern New Mexico tradition. Tell us about the Cascarones.
Well, I'm a Santa Fe girl. I was born and raised here in Santa Fe, and I started going to this baile since I was, about 4 years old when I could walk, or after I could walk. And it's a Spanish tradition, and there's two parts to them. One of them is the cascarones, and for those who don't know Spanish, a cascara is an eggshell. So a cascaron is a confetti-filled eggshell. And
so you blow out with your mouth the content, the yolk and the white of the uncooked egg with little
exactly.
pinholes in each side. Suddenly you have an empty egg
you can
decorate and fill with confetti.
Absolutely. And the tradition is that you go to this dance. It's always held a week after Easter. And when you go to this dance, if you want to ask a partner to dance, you break one of these cascarones over your partner's head. And it's so much fun because everybody walks around with all of this confetti and the eggshells. And that's just the first part. But the
now,
second
do the
part
girls and the boys all both ask each other?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I often go and will break it, some cascarones over my dad's head or uncle's head or just anybody who looks like they would have fun dancing. And the dance is great because there are all the old-fashioned colonial dances. You do some polkas and waltzes and schottische and some fun ones like the broom dance or the handkerchief dance
right.
or the baile de los compadres.
And so you made a lovely children's book about this with both English and Spanish.
Yes. I wanted this tradition to be preserved, and I've been going, like I said, since I was, about 4 years old, just a little toddler, and I really loved it. And the more that I went to the dance, it was the same people coming, and I thought, I want to preserve this for generations. So what better way than to teach the young ones? And I felt like a children's book would be a great avenue for preserving this tradition and doing it in English and Spanish because it is very much a Spanish colonial type tradition. So I got my mother, Socorro Aragon, and my uncle, George Gonzalez, to do the translation for me into Spanish. And we put together this beautiful children's book, and I love the color. It's very eye-catching. It's very much like Easter, and it's very fun, which translates what this dance is all about.
Do you find that people are, especially people who, with a mind to preserving tradition, are raising their kids bilingual, so maybe they'll read them the storybook one night in English and another night in Spanish before they go to bed, that kind of thing?
I don't know if there are a lot of parents, but I know within my family, certainly, we want you to grow up with traditions. When I go talk to kids, I say traditions are the things that bind your family together. Mary Charlotte, if you think about your family, you talked about your mom blowing out the eggs.
Yeah, the Germans have the same thing.
Exactly. These are things that create memories, that create that bond between families. And I think that's what traditions are all about, whether it's the tradition that you have at Christmas, whether it's a Sunday dinner tradition, whether it's just getting together for a picnic every Fourth of July, whatever, these traditions are what really bind families together. And this is one that certainly has been very important for our family and hopefully for other families in the Santa Fe area and New Mexico area as well.
And also between families. So all the different people who show up to this are all members of your community who you might not see socially any other time of year.
Right. This dance was originally an icebreaker for the community, a chance for everyone to get together. A couple of things. During Lent in the old days, and I'm talking about the 1860s or, into the early 1900s, many of the Spanish that settled in northern New Mexico were very fervent Catholics. So they didn't eat meat during Lent at all. So instead, they had a lot of egg dishes. They prepared all these egg dishes as a protein substitute, and they collected their little eggshells. And they couldn't dance. So that was part of the penance and the sacrifice. So by the time that Easter came around, it was really time to celebrate. And it was time to bring the community together to just have fun after this time of really being very disciplined. So that's what this tradition is all about.
Carla Aragon is the author of Dance of the Eggshells, Baile de los Cascarones, a wonderful bilingual children's book. And we will see you at the New Mexico Women Authors Book Festival.
I'm looking forward to it. And thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. I appreciate the time talking with you.
Thank you. I'd like now to welcome poet and artist Susan Gardner. She is also part of the New Mexico Women Authors Book Festival, and she's got a couple of books here, books of poetry, Box of Light and Stone Music, The Art and Poetry of Susan Gardner. And you are going to be giving a talk, Susan, which is kind of, you're calling it an accidental talk.
Yes, on Friday at 2 in the afternoon at the New Mexico History Museum downtown in Santa Fe. I had proposed several topics as alternatives to talk about reading and writing in a multicultural life, poetry here and now, and also the effect of Buddhist philosophy on our perceptions of reality. However, I thought that the festival would choose one of those, but they interpreted it as one talk. So I found a way to link them together, and in fact, we will end with a kind of game based on those ideas.
That people can participate in?
Yes, it's not a game unless they play.
Right. So it's a part, sort of at the end, it's a participatory
yes.
talk. So when you talk about living a multicultural life, what does that mean to you?
Well, I grew up in New York, but I lived my young life in Asia, in Korea, in Japan. For most of 20 years, I was involved with East Asia. And, of course, I live here. And I lived in Mexico for some time. I speak Korean, Japanese, Spanish, French, a little tiny bit of Italian, and some English. And I can make myself a fool in all six.
And so how do you integrate those both personally and in your work as an artist, as a poet?
Well, I think that speaking a new language or being in a new culture requires that we pay attention. And this is, in fact, a very good thing. When you enter a new culture, you don't have any clues about how to do things, what's right, what's wrong. It's like speaking a new language. You don't have the clues that tell you what those sounds mean. So you have to pay a lot of attention. You have to be awake in order to function in that new environment. And that's kind of the job of an artist, too, is to pay attention, to notice things, to focus on what we actually see, and then record what we understand about what we've seen in a way that another person can understand that discovery as well.
When you look at your own work, I imagine it's not always easy to do while you're doing it, but when you look back, for example, on the books that we have here that we're talking about, do you see influences of these different places that you've lived?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I first went to Asia when I was only 22 years old, and I lived there a long time in urban environments and very, very rural environments. I'll tell you something funny. The biggest culture shock I ever had was in Virginia. Culture shock is a kind of anxiety and missed cues and lack of understanding when you enter a new culture. And I had never lived in the suburbs. I'm a city girl originally. And
so you've done city, urban and rural, but no suburban.
I'd never lived in the suburbs
before.
How
did you end up in the Virginia suburbs?
Oh, well, my first husband's job took him all around. So I had no idea how to live there. I'd been away from the United States for 7 very important years, almost all of the 60s. And then I came back, and I didn't know how to function. I was constantly confused.
And what did you do? Did you use your artwork or your poetry or writing as a way to navigate?
I wanted to. It was very difficult. My kids were very young. And I had no idea, really, truly, I had no idea how to manage suburban life. We take it kind of for granted in Santa Fe that we'll live at distances from each other and that you'll get in your car for everything and that the mores and social values that go with single-family ownership of a house, we think that's kind of almost universal, but it isn't. A lot of the world doesn't relate to that, and I had never experienced it, so I had to learn it all.
Susan Gardner will be at the New Mexico Women Authors Book Festival on Friday. She'll be giving a talk from 2 to 3 at the New Mexico History Museum, and she will also be reading poetry on Saturday at 3:15.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm very happy now to welcome Trish Porter. She is the author of the book Rekindle Your Dreams. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So you were a member of the 1988 U.S. Olympic team, and you were a national champion and world champion in high jump. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. And my the world record is really on the master's level for women age 40 and up.
So you were on the Olympic team, and then basically you had an accident, which was, as you put it, your own darn fault. What happened then? That it was a big setback for you.
Did I hurt my neck, and so that really forced me to retire. But then I ended up having 2 children, and 11 years went by, and then at the age of 40, I decided to start competing again.
What was it like at that age when they say that all athletes, women and men, are really kind of over the hill? What was it like to make that decision?
You know, it was so exciting and thrilling because I love to jump and I love to train. So for me, it was really fulfilling a new dream, being able to come back and to high jump again and compete on the national and international level on the Masters. It was just wonderful. It was a lot of fun.
What did you gain that you didn't have, let's say, when you were in your teens and 20s? What do you have as an athlete when you're in your 40s, and what have you lost?
You know what? I think you gain appreciation. Appreciation for each day that you're out there and you can train or high jump, do something you love. You're so thankful and you're so grateful. I felt like it was a gift from God to be able to do that again at that age. What have I lost? Probably you're not as strong as what I used to be, and yet mentally you feel like it, but your body has aged, and so you feel the effects of aging.
How do you counter those in order to become a world-level champion?
You know what? I try to listen to my body more than what I did when I was younger, and I try to eat healthier, better nutrition. I have a great team of people who help keep me healthy, whether it be chiropractors and massage therapists, trigger point therapists, things like that. So I have to do a little bit more of that than what I did when I was younger.
There's something that I've always wanted to ask somebody who was an Olympic and world-level athlete, which is, I know that it's your dream, I know that you strive and you win, what is so thrilling about doing the same thing every day, every day, every day, jumping and getting a little bit higher and a little bit higher? What is the magic of it?
That's a great question. You know what? I think it's going beyond what you think you're able to do and pushing yourself beyond what you ever imagined. And then the experiences that go with it. You know, for me, it's the people you meet along the way, whether it be when you're training each day, whether it be on the track or in the gym, or maybe the people in the other country or at the competitions. Really, as you're older, it changes. So it's pushing your body beyond. And then it's just the daily things you get to do, that you enjoy.
How does having that kind of practice filter out into the rest of your life?
Wow, well, you learn a lot of valuable lessons. You learn a lot about persistence. You learn a lot about not giving up. And then now, after the age of 40, my children get to learn from me, and they get to learn by example. I just don't have to tell them the benefits of working hard. I think they get to see that from me, and they get to see the travel that I do. They get to watch me do personal best, and they know what I've given up, and they know the sacrifices, and they know the hard work that it takes to really achieve something that you desire and you dream to do.
Trish Porter is an Olympian and National World Masters champion. She's the author of the book Rekindle Your Dreams, which we didn't even really talk about, but you'll be at the New Mexico Book Festival, so people can Women Authors Book Festival, and so people can talk to you there.
Yes, and you know, I also talk about it, and it's Rekindle Your Dreams and Energize Your Life. So it's not just for an athlete, it's really for anybody who has any sort of a dream and who wants some more energy in their life.
Trish Porter, thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like now to welcome Jennifer Cervantes. She is the author of the book Tortilla Sun. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So this is a book, would you call it a children's book or a middle school age? How is it classified?
Well, by the publishing industry, it's actually classified as a middle grade novel, which puts it in the age group of about 8 to 12.
And so how do you write for that age group?
Well, you know, it takes a lot of imagination, and I always tell writers, and I follow this advice myself, which is to write from the heart. So to tell the stories that you know, to speak about what inspires you. And so often it's easy to draw on your own experience as a child, especially if you have those memories present and can draw on those quickly. So I do that, but mostly I just write from my heart, and I think about what inspires me, what I think children would enjoy reading.
So what was the inspiration for the book Tortilla Sun?
Well, the primary inspiration was actually my daughter, Juliana. She asked me to write a story for her, which was about a bear that she has. And I became addicted when I put the pen to paper and I started writing. And it grew into Tortilla Sun. And the other is I'm so inspired by the beauty and enchantment of New Mexico. I knew I wanted that as a backdrop and setting for a middle grade novel, for a children's novel. So both of those inspired me.
So where does the book start?
The book starts with Izzy Roybal. She's 12 years old. She's unpacking in yet another apartment in San Diego with her mother. She's moved around a lot. And her mother has recently received funding for her PhD program to finish her dissertation in Costa Rica. And so Izzy is sent to New Mexico, to a fictional northern New Mexico village, to spend the summer with her Nana, who she really doesn't know. She's met maybe once or twice. And so there the story begins to unfold and the mystery unwinds.
And are you based in New Mexico?
Yes, I am. I'm in Las Cruces, New Mexico.
So do you draw on New Mexico cultural influences, obviously?
Absolutely, absolutely.
The book employs what, in a literary terms, is called magical realism. What does that mean to you?
Well, when I think about magical realism, it's so deeply rooted to me in the Hispanic culture. And I couldn't imagine writing any magical or for that culture without incorporating some of the magical realism. So it's the magic in the ordinary, the magic in our everyday lives. And that was so easy to fall into in this northern New Mexico village. And in Nana, the character, who's also a curandera, and in Socorro, who is the storyteller, and in the way the wind speaks to Izzy and helps her unravel the mystery. So there's so many elements that are part of the book, and I just can't imagine it not being there, given the topic of the book.
What's so interesting is that there are moments where you're reading a book of magical realism and you think, this isn't magical realism, this is realism.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, and, you know, hopefully that does come across. And I know that several people who have written the book or reviewed the book said that they came to the book hoping that it wasn't going to be magic and fantasy, that it really would incorporate some of the magical realism components that were so important to that genre. And so, I hope that people enjoy it, and I hope that I was able to achieve that and that kids can enjoy it, too, because if you think about it, when you're a child, I mean, so much of their world is filled with magic, and they want to believe in magic. And so I think that it was a nice mix and blend for the book.
What kind of responses so far have you gotten from your readers, from your young readers?
You know, I've been really fortunate. I've received some wonderful emails from kids, and what's great about kids is they're so brutally honest with you about their reading. So I've gotten emails from kids who said, this is my favorite book. I've read it 5 times. And I've gotten emails from kids who said, well, it wasn't my favorite book, but I liked it.
Do you have more girl readers?
I do, I think. Or that's at least who reaches out to me. And at my book signings, I have a lot of girls present. As well, although I will say that there's a lot to enjoy for young boys, because Mateo is another protagonist in the novel who is a treasure seeker, and he's trying to find a treasure and all of these ideas linked to legend and archaeology. And so I think there's something in it for both boys and girls.
Jennifer Cervantes is author of the book Tortilla Sun, and we will see you this weekend at the New Mexico Women Authors Book Festival.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm very happy now to welcome Veronica Golos. She is a poet. Her most recent book is called A Bell Buried Deep, and her forthcoming book this coming year is called Vocabulary of Silence. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
So I wanted to give you a chance to just read some of your poems. So where do you want to start?
Well, I'd like to read, just to start, 2 poems from A Bell Buried Deep, and then we'll see where we go from there.
Okay, go ahead.
The first poem I'd like to read is the title poem, A Bell Buried Deep. Feasting on the aftertaste, I weaken first, rise, stand at the window. My pale skin flushed in the North Carolina light. The old wood planks moan, the white bedspread ripples like new snow. Our white sheets are the color of white beneath white, and you, your brown skin against the sheet, our marriage the color of syrup. I lift my eyes and am chastened by the angry heartbreak this world can bring. The treetops are tender green, and what is the color green, but everything washed clean, even the tiny blue stone cemetery, where my son remains, does not rise, even after this, his 11th year. He is blue in the ground, his light blue bones, the midnight cap of his hair, his infant smell, a bell buried deep, where he was in me, ringing, ringing. My God, love-making can redeem but does not release pain. I do not forget my periwinkle boy, my blue berry, my demon, all his names in a world pulsing with names, wild christenings in the air. As the blue-green vein of my wrist beats, the memory of him, our pale-boned boy, drives me back to our bed to touch you, his dark father, with my grief full of tongues, full with his name.
Veronica Golos, A Bell Buried Deep. Is this from a story from your life?
This is a story from my life, but in poetry, which is broader than my life. And it's the title poem of this book, which is, this book, A Bell Buried Deep, is what's called a midrash. I've taken the biblical story of Sarah and Hagar, and I take it from pre-biblical to biblical to two characters under slavery in the United States to the final imaginary present. And so it's about these two women and childbearing and how can they come to love one another.
Would you like to read another poem?
Yes, thank you. From again, this is sort of towards the end of the book of A Bellberry Deep, and it's a Coney Island praise song. In pale early morning, I stumble along the damp boardwalk. I'm inside myself, as if blind, hands outstretched, feeling at the wet air. I've stepped into sight. I'm caught in its net. My dreams are salt between my teeth. The dolphins sing like bells, like chimes, their tinkling bliss. I hear them as if I were aboard a ship rocking. I hear the creak of wood, the ancient sail. Their song calls up my broken dead. For so long I have held the rosary of their bones, bleached and holy. Now I open my hand to find only lines. I've shed my scars, one by one, like notes, like letters, thin wafers of prayer I can taste upon my tongue. It is ecstasy to laugh, let go my measured heart, to see the dolphins rise, orchids beneath their lids. In their mouth is infant light, and within their ornate sound, my dead sing praise songs now.
Veronica Golos, her book is called A Bell Buried Deep. That's her latest book of poetry. And we will see you at the New Mexico Women Authors Book Festival this weekend.
Right. I'm reading on Saturday the last section towards the end. I think it's around 3 o'clock or so, or 2:40. Yeah.
Excellent. Good. Well, people can go find you there.
Yes, I hope they will.
Good. Thank you so much.
You are so welcome, and thank you, Mary Charlotte.
I'm delighted now to welcome Dora Callett Wong. She is the author of the book The Kitchen Shrink, A Psychiatrist's Reflections on Healing in a Changing World, and Helene Silverblatt. She's the author of the book Harvest of Blossoms, Poems from a Life Cut Short, and they're both part of the New Mexico Women's Book Festival, Women Authors Book Festival. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
Hi.
So the two of you are friends and colleagues and authors and psychiatrists.
Yes. Correct.
And the books are quite different. Let's start with Harvest of Blossoms, a fascinating book. It's kind of another Anne Frank almost.
Exactly. And Selma Meerbaum-Eisinger, who is actually the poet whose poems we've translated into English for the first time, was our cousin, and we were her closest living relatives. And we didn't even know she existed until
about... you mean not yours and mine, but yours and
twin sisters and mine and our mother's.
Right.
She was my mother's first cousin. And we only found out, in 1980 or so, that we had this very gifted cousin who had left behind in some miraculous way a book of 57 poems that have survived.
That survived World War II, survived the Holocaust, and she didn't survive. She died as a teenager.
That's right. She died at 18 in a forced labor camp. But before she was deported, she gave the volume to a friend who gave it to the love of her life, who then took it with him to another forced labor camp. When he was on his way to try to go to Palestine, he was afraid something would happen to the poetry, and he gave it to another friend. He was killed, but the friend kept the poems with her. She traveled the refugee's journey across Europe until 1948, when she was allowed to go to Israel. And at that time, she kept the poems in her backpack. All of her luggage was lost, and the poems survived.
And then how did you find them?
We found them because another cousin of ours named Paul Celan, who's actually a very well-known poet, insisted that her poetry be published with his when he was asked by a German press to publish his very well-known Todesfuge. And he published her poem next to his. Then
a German journalist read the poem and said, I have to find them. How could this? She must have more poems. And he went on an amazing journey from house to house in Israel, trying to find, among the community of people from this town, which is a sort of a magical place, Chernivtsi, trying to find anyone who might know where the poems were. And he eventually found them and found one of our surviving cousins, who then gave permission to have the poems published in German.
Amazing. And among many, many other things that we could talk about, and I hope we have more of a chance to talk it on this show another time, they show the depth of love that happens in adolescence.
Yes. And I think what's wonderful about the poems is not only how frank she is about her feelings for Eliezer Fichman, the man she loves, but the feelings are so universal that people have been drawn to them, and they've become actually quite popular in Germany. But they also address her time, and I think you can't divorce her from the context in which she wrote and the time in which she wrote. And so you can see the poems getting darker, but there's always a ray of hope in them, and I think that's what draws people to them as well.
Now, Dora, your book, The Kitchen Shrink, documents what you very euphemistically call a changing world.
Yes.
Tell us about how you came to write this book.
Well, it's my memoir of being a psychiatrist and a mother. And I think it's a kind of a common sense view of our healthcare system. I love the literary form of memoir. Usually memoirs tell stories of personal importance. And I wanted to use the art form of memoir to explore an issue of more societal importance. I think as a psychiatrist, I've practiced through a time of tremendous change. We used to have doctors who we had lifelong personal relationships with, who used to make house calls. And now, for most of us, our primary medical relationship is with an insurance company. Similarly, for psychiatry, when we used to go see psychiatrists, we would get therapy. But now medications are the main thing psychiatrists offer. So I realized that these are tremendous changes, not just for my profession of psychiatry, but for society. But mostly I wanted to write a memoir to leave a record of what it's been like to be a mother, a physician, a psychiatrist, at this, I believe, a real pivotal point in our history.
Well, and part of the dynamic here is that the healthcare system has moved from giving healthcare to making money in a way necessarily very good for patients.
Yeah, and that's another story I wanted to tell, that it wasn't always this way, but medicine was deregulated in 1980, along with the airline industry and other industries. And, we don't hear a lot about it. We hear about the financial industry being deregulated, what a disaster that's been. But healthcare was deregulated also.
And what did that mean for healthcare?
Well, it meant that our nation's hospitals and medical system were basically built by charities, nonprofits, and that's why they're named for saints, like St. Vincent and Santa Fe. But the profit motive was actually kind of kept out of medical care. When you went to see a doctor, they were supposed to care about you and not about their dollars. But now for-profit corporations have taken over these hospitals built by charities and communities over most of the 20th century.
And, it's ironic when you think about it, because doctors have always, in this country, made a decent salary, and now it's not about doctors getting wealthy, but companies and shareholders that aren't providing care in the first place.
Yes, and that's why one-third of our medical dollars goes to administration. In Taiwan, it's 2%.
Right.
In Germany and France and most European countries, about 5%. But one-third of American healthcare dollars go to administration, and that's not healthcare.
Well, much, much more to talk about, but I want to thank you both for being here, Dora Kallett Wong and Helene Silverblatt. The books are The Kitchen Shrink and Harvest of Blossoms, and they will both be at the 3rd Annual New Mexico Women Authors Book Festival, which is happening Friday through Sunday. I'm so glad you were both here at the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you so much for inviting us.
The New Mexico Women Authors Book Festival runs Friday, October 1st through Sunday, October 3rd. from 11 to 5 at the New Mexico History Museum. There will be all kinds of festivities and food throughout the day. For more information, go to newmexicocreates.org. And by the way, Christy Hengst, the artist of the wonderful installation called Birds in the Park, which we talked about at another day on this show, is speaking tonight, Thursday, at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. For more information, call Santa Fe Art Institute at 424-5050. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz.